Welcome to this session on particle physics. It is my very great pleasure to introduce to you today Karl Kremner, who is professor at New York University and also associate professor with the Center of Data Science. Karl has been working for many years with the ATLAS collaboration at CERN, which is one of the major experiments on the Large Hadron Collider. And he's been working at the interface of AI, machine learning, and physics for many years, and is the recipient of a very prestigious award, the Presidential Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers, which is the highest honor bestowed by the US government on outstanding scientists and engineers in the early stages of their independent research career. Thank you very much, Karl, for accepting to give us this presentation.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Isabel. It's really a great honor to be here and to have this opportunity. I'm very excited to talk about this with you. I have a story, really, that goes from the very small to the very, very large. This is what we study in fundamental particle physics. And it's also a story about artificial intelligence, the deep learning revolution, and other forms of machine learning and inference. I thought I would start a little bit by going back to yesterday and Drew's excellent talk, which he set a very high bar and with his beautiful animations and things like this. But I like the framing of nature needs AI and AI needs nature. And I think there's a very analogous statement to be said for physics, and that physics needs AI and AI needs physics. And so, in particular, a lot of AI methodologies, you know, have some background in either statistical physics, et cetera. Of course, the LHC is producing enormous amounts of data. Other fields of physics are producing enormous amounts of data. It's very complicated, and so artificial intelligence has a huge role to play there. But there's also another aspect of that that I'd like to say, which is, you know, definitely much more speculative. Drew showed this this picture up when he was talking about ecology, about emergent systems, and so you have the bears and et cetera on the right representing these emergent phenomena and fields of science that are, you know, like language, ecology, psychology, perception, where the models tend to be more descriptive in nature, and the causal structure is often very, very unclear, and that's what makes those very difficult problems. And on the other side, you have a very reductionist picture, and certainly particle physics is a hallmark of that, of this reductionist picture. They're not in conflict, they just represent phenomena at different scales. And there you have things like particle physics, cosmology, to some extent, things like protein folding, where you have a very mechanistic model for what's going on, but it's just very difficult. And even things like climate science, you know, you have a mechanistic model, but then, of course, there's more and more uncertainties, so you're sort of moving from one extreme to the other. And I think that, you know, it's interesting that the use of artificial intelligence and sort of interesting problems that it's been applied to have, you know, largely been related to things on the right, like language and health. And that's very interesting and very promising and has huge impact on our world, but they're also very challenging, partially because the causal structure is so unclear. So maybe it's the case that instead of eventually AI getting to understanding the fundamental laws of the universe, maybe that's actually a good place to start. Maybe AI should start with problems where the causal structure is much more clear and we have these more mechanistic models about what's going on. So that's certainly very speculative, but this talk is going to be sort of the story about how that what that might look like in the context of particle physics. So I'm going to start now with a couple of quotes that helped me frame you know, the structure of this talk also. So one is a quote from Jan LeCun, who was at CERN not long ago, and he said, of course, particle physicists are among the first to realize that nature is compositional. And I think by particle physicists, he means all the way back to the Greeks and et cetera, not just modern particle physicists. And then there's also this great quote from Jason Eisner saying that either the world is compositional or there is a God. And I think that so this idea of things being very compositional and the natural world being compositional and that being somewhat related to some of the successes in AI is important, and you'll definitely see that's a very strong theme in particle physics, not only at the theoretical level but also at the data analysis level. So at the starting theoretical level, you know, we're thinking about, you know, you, me, the matter in this room being made up out of atoms, the atoms being made out of electrons and a nucleus. The nucleus is made out of protons and neutrons, and they are in turn made out of quarks. And, you know, we can ask if there's even more substructure there. We haven't seen anything like that yet, but certainly we're looking for it. And so we have this very, very small table of particles on the right, and everything we've ever seen in any lab experiment can be described by just those set of particles and four fundamental interactions between them. So you have gravity, which is familiar, electricity and magnetism, which is amazing because it describes all of chemistry, how your cell phone works, electronics, and then two more unfamiliar forces that are inside the nucleus related to keeping the nucleus together and radioactive decay and things like that. So the impressive thing is that it's not just a table and some sort of descriptive picture. It's very mathematically precise. So we have this equation here called the Lagrangian for the standard model. This is something that I teach graduate students how to interpret and how to turn that equation into predictions that we would expect to see at various kinds of experiments. And now what's impressive also about that theory is that it has 19 parameters, okay? And it's consistent with probably 70 years of very precise experiments. So if you think of it from a machine learning point of view, to have a model with the capacity of 19 parameters that's able to describe decades and thousands of experiments in very different circumstances is definitely a tour de force. So there are parameters and there are parameters. And so these are the last one of the ones to be measured is the mass of the Higgs boson, and that was measured just a few years ago. And so that completed the so-called standard model of particle physics. When you talk about cosmology, it's very, very similar situation. You're talking now at very big scales. You're thinking about Einstein's theory for general relativity. You're thinking about how the universe is expanded and how it's evolving. And there, it's just a six-parameter model that describes the universe at large scales, and it describes a number of different experiments. So it's so the fact that this very small model can describe such a wide range of phenomena is very impressive. And one of the ones that's really a hallmark of this field is that if you look way back towards, very far away, back towards the beginning of the universe, towards the Big Bang, the universe becomes so hot and dense that around the temperature of the sun, atoms ionize, and then the universe is opaque at that level. So you can't see any farther, but what's interesting is now you can actually see that surface. So we actually take a picture of this surface, which is very far away, with a camera that sees in microwave frequencies, and that's the picture that you see on the right. It's almost perfectly uniform, and it's actually confusing how it can be so uniform because those things are out of causal contact. But once you subtract off the sort of constant and correct for the fact that we're moving with respect to that surface and there's a Doppler shift, you're left over with this picture that you see with very small fluctuations. And those fluctuations are a Gaussian process. Okay, it's just exactly a Gaussian process. And the covariance structure of that process is predicted from these six parameters. And if you look, for instance, at the power spectrum of that what's going on in that map, you see the plot in the bottom right, and the data and the model fit like incredibly well. And it's not so easy to get a model to fit that precise of data with just six parameters. So there's a lot going on in there, and those peaks have very important physical meaning. So that's sort of what we're going at. But if you look at it, there are a few things that are surprises. And usually we would present that as a pie chart. But for this audience, I'll present it as a cake. So the ordinary matter that we know is just 5% of the universe. That's the sort of cherry on top, the stars and dust and et cetera. And then 25% of the universe, we know where it is, but we have no idea what it is. You might call it the dark matter of physics. Then there's another 70%, which is what we call dark energy. And that also, we don't really know what it is. So there are definitely some very big mysteries for us to try to address. So there are more I've listed here. One of them is, why is there more matter than antimatter in the universe? And various other more technical issues. But we're trying to address those. And so here, this is now I'm going to tie the two together, is that if you look past that surface where the universe becomes opaque at the very primordial era of the universe, it's going through lots of phase changes. And that's where, for instance, you start to see atoms break into nuclei breaking apart, quarks, you know, forming and things like this. And that's what we're studying at the Large Hadron Collider. The energies that we're probing are the energies of the primordial universe. And so we see these fundamental particles. And as we go back towards the Big Bang, we're going higher in energy. And now we're looking for things like the Higgs boson, supersymmetry, dark matter, extra dimensions of space and time. And so now we've found the Higgs boson. This animation's out of date. But I'm going to sort of tell you a little bit about that process. Okay, so here we are, starting at the big scale. We're gonna try to zoom through this because it's too long of a video. It's beautiful. I had my in-house people whip this up. So here we go. This is Geneva, Switzerland, and this is where the laboratory CERN is. And you can see the Lake Geneva, the airport there, and then this is the Large Hadron Collider. So it's huge. It's about 100 meters underground. There are four really big experiments. I work on one called ATLAS. It's about the size of an 11-story building. So CMS is our kind of friendly competitor on the other side of the ring. There are protons spinning around in this ring that are going essentially the speed of light. And they collide. And so now I'm going to let the video play here. So we're going to zoom into the beam and take a ride with one of these protons. There's another proton coming from the opposite direction, and they're going to collide in the middle of these big particle detectors, which are like sort of like huge three-dimensional cameras. So when they hit, there's so much energy that through E equals MC squared, you can actually produce mass, produce new particles that were not there before. They come flying out and hit our big detectors. Detectors have about 100 million sensors in them, and the collisions happen 600 million times a second. Okay, so let that sink in for a little bit. So the data payload is just truly phenomenal. So I'm gonna zip ahead a little bit here. So all this data is streaming off. The other thing is that not all of these collisions are interesting. Only about 1 in a million of the collisions are kind of what we're after. The rest of them are things we've studied in the past, but because of quantum mechanics, we have no control over what happens. They just, you know, the collisions happen and you are sampling some probability distribution that nature gave you, and we are interested in the extreme tails of that distribution. So off goes the data, and we can't keep it all because it would be, you know, something like 100 terabytes a second. So we have very, very fast electronics that are looking at that data in real time, trying to decide what's interesting or not. And at the first level of the filter that happens, we keep about 1 in 10,000 of the events, and that's still 100 gigabytes a second of data streaming off. And so then there's another, say, factor of 100, and that is what's saved permanently to storage that we end up analyzing. Okay, so here's just some pictures. This is what the Large Hadron Collider looks like. You can see the two little ribbons, these beams of particles. They come into collisions in the detectors. This is the ATLAS experiment when it was still being constructed. You can see a person there for scale. Now every bit of it is filled with electronics. This is the CMS experiment when it was being built, but further along. And inside the CMS experiment, you also have these amazing technologies. Like this is a crystal of lead tungstate. It's like a clear crystal of lead. Sounds like a science fiction movie. Here's a piece of ATLAS. I like this one because look at all those fiber optic cables coming off of this detector, right? I mean, there's just a tremendous amount of data. Okay, so let's go back now to the theory. So this is Peter Higgs, and in 1964, he was sitting around thinking about how we could resolve some technical problem in the theory and how we can accommodate massive fundamental particles, because otherwise we didn't know how to deal with massive fundamental particles. And so he came up with this nice, elegant solution along with some others, and it made a prediction that there should be a new particle, and we call that particle the Higgs boson. So what would it look like? The good part is the theory is so predictive, we know exactly what it would look like if this theory is true, and this is what it would look like. And this is also an event that was collected in June of 2012. And what's happened here is the protons collided. It made a Higgs boson, we think, that decayed instantaneously into two Z bosons that instantaneously decayed into four muons. And those are the little red lines flying out of the detector. And that's what we actually observe. So we have to try to work backwards to try to figure out if there actually was a Higgs boson that was produced or not. So you might think that we saw it, everyone was super excited. For some reason, the woman on the bottom right is not excited. Everyone else is very excited. And then articles are written and we're done. But of course, there's a lot more to it. And so now I'd like to kind of go into the details a little bit about how this works. And I'm going to speak sort of generally about high energy physics now, not just about the Higgs, is that our sort of high level inference goals are to do searches for new physics, which you can cast in terms of hypothesis testing or classification, measurements where we want to try to do, say, maximum likelihood estimates of some of the parameters of our theories. And we'd also like to kind of constrain the regions of those, the parameter spaces of those theories to say which parts are ruled out and which parts are still consistent with the data. And typically, we use likelihood-based techniques for doing that. You can multiply by a prior and be Bayesian if you want, but the likelihood is really the fundamental object there. And the thing that was somewhat surprising, I somehow knew but never thought of it in this way until not too long ago, is that we lack a nice technique for doing likelihood-based inference when we want to work with a high-dimensional description of the data and we have a detector simulation involved. And I'm going to try to get into that some more. So I'm going to start to talk more about inference now. And so the central object, centrally in the slide, is a statistical model, P of X given theta and nu. So it's a probability distribution for the data X for given the parameters theta and nu. And I'm going to separate out theta, which are things that I really care about measuring, the parameters of interest, and nu, the nuisance parameters. And also, you'll see, I want you to really think of theta as physics parameters, like of a theory, not of as parameters of a neural network or something like that. But we will see how they're related more later. So in this forward modeling, the predictive step where I, given the parameters, I try to generate some data, that's the sort of top forward modeling prediction simulation side of things. And then given data, I can also try to do the inverse process and try to estimate what the values of the parameters are, and that's what I'm referring to as inference. Okay. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the forward model so you can get a bit of a feel for what we're doing and what we're up against. So the story really starts from first principles with quantum field theory and this equation that I showed you. The theory is able to predict what you would expect to happen in certain kinds of collisions. And that process goes from sort of, say, two incoming particles to order 10 particles like you see here. And then there's an extra step of that that evolves it into sort of order 100 particles that are flying out into the detector. Then we have to model interactions of those particles with the detector, and that leads to a representation of the data that's about 100 million dimensional because that's how many sensors there are. And then finally, we take that raw data and we try to, you know, work on it to reduce the complexity of it and to some higher level description of what's going on, like I think there was an electron here or a muon there or something like that, and they had these energies and angles and things like that. And usually there's about maybe 10 to 30 features of the event that are really the kind of essential thing where most of the information lies. So I'm going to just kind of say the same thing again quickly, is that that simulation kind of goes really from, at the very beginning, something that you can do with a pencil and paper. So there's some drawing here, but that corresponds to a calculation that's a real calculation that I teach graduate students how to do. And the point there is that it starts with theta, and it takes me, you could say, to some latent space Z1. And then it evolves to another version of the latent space, and the model that makes that evolution is still principled, but it's more approximate. We have to do some controlled approximations to the theory. And then the last stage is much more phenomenological. It's not really a first principles theory in the same way, and so we're kind of evolving through this latent space, and we're picking up nuisance parameters along the way. And then we get to the detector. We have to embed this thing in the detector, and what's amazing here is just, you know, the particles are flying out. The way we model the detector is literally, you know, the interaction of matter is literally at the atomic scale, like scattering off nuclei, ionizing atoms, and things like that. So we're modeling something the size of an 11-story building at the atomic scale, right? So you get these very complicated-looking showers. That's what these kinds of big blobs are, these energy deposits in the detector. And that's like the sort of one of the latent sort of descriptions of what's going on in this process. And then finally, we go from there to the actual raw data in the simulation. So if I was going to draw that as a sort of graphical model, this is a kind of a not too technical of a graphical model, so it's sort of a flowchart slash graphical model. At the very top, you have theoretical parameters, parameters of interest that I care about. Those are the thetas. And then I'm evolving through this kind of high level to lower and lower and lower level latent description of what's going on, Z1, Z2, and Z3. Those are the boxes inside. On the left, I have nuisance parameters that are important for that modeling process. And then finally, I get to the data at the bottom, that the gray box in the center in the middle. You also, these plates are sort of how often these things happen. So remember, we have roughly 10 to the 15 events. For each of those events, we might have 10 or 100 kind of particles flying around, and there are 100 million sensors. So just keep the scale in mind, okay? Now, these similar kinds of graphical models are also used in other fields. So this one I like a lot. It's really beautiful work about trying to model at the pixel level what's happening in huge astronomical surveys. So the modeling for that is thinking about what galaxies look like, what kind, stars and galaxies, then what populations on the sky look like, then thinking about at the image level what's going on, and then at the pixel level what's going on, including what's called the point spread function of how when a photon comes in to the detector, what it's seen on the image of the telescope. So this is beautiful work, but I'd say that in order to make this sort of practical, they had to make a number of simplifying assumptions. And at the level of precision that's happening for some of the astronomy and astrophysics, those are totally fine assumptions, and that allows them to use things like variational inference, and which is very powerful. We had a very lovely tutorial about it. The problem is that for us, if we're not going to make those simplifying assumptions and we're really going to think about the detector simulation, conceptually, the detector simulation is the probability of the detector response given some incoming particles. And the way that's implemented is through some huge Monte Carlo integration over some microphysics. And the consequence is that the evaluation of the likelihood is no longer tractable, okay? So we can't do typical likelihood-based inference, and that motivates a new class of inferential algorithms based on what we're calling likelihood-free inference. And they only require the ability to use a simulator or a generative model in the forward mode, so you'd be able to generate samples. You're never able to evaluate the likelihood of a given sample. So you might think that that black box variational inference would be able to handle this. These are some slides from the really excellent tutorial that we had on Monday from David and Rajesh and Shakir. But one of the things here is that the term black box is being kind of overloaded. Black box in this situation really means that the inference algorithm is a black box inference algorithm, but one of the inputs to that inference algorithm is the likelihood function. So if you're in this likelihood-free setting, you can't use black box variational inference. However, many of the other ideas that are happening, the idea of approximate inference, the idea of these change of variable tricks, and all these new things that are popping up in terms of bijective maps and things like this, these are all still very relevant for a number of other topics, and I'm very excited about this set of ideas. Okay. So what do we do? Because physicists have been doing likelihood-free inference for decades. So how do we do it? It's a really simple approach, and it's that from these 100 million sensors that are read out, we end up boiling the data down to essentially one variable. And the feature engineering process is the task of a skilled physicist that knows what they want to do and what kinds of variables are going to be good for whatever the inference task is. So for instance, if you're looking for the Higgs boson, we know a good variable to make, and you would take the 100 million dimensional sensor data and compress it into one number, which is an estimate of the mass of the Higgs particle. But this approach, and then I should say that we can do this for many, many samples, and then we can just build a histogram or any other kind of univariate density estimation. And the fact that we can do that then allows us, we have now an approximation of the likelihood function, and that is possible because we reduce the dimensionality of the data. But this approach does not scale if you want to work in high-dimensional data. And I don't mean like 100 million dimensional data, I mean like 10-dimensional data. You can't fill histograms in 10 dimensions, and most density techniques are not very trustworthy density estimation techniques are not very trustworthy once you're above, say, five-ish dimensions. So what we do instead is we have now the kind of right branch, which is all deterministic. This is like feed forward type of from going from very low level features at the bottom to mid level features to high level features to really a very high event level description of the data. And then from there, we can finally do inference. And that's basically what's happening. I should also say that sometimes we don't need to really, let me go back actually. In this process of coming back up, it's sort of like trying to reconstruct the latent state of what's going on. It's not exactly one-to-one, but it's roughly the same. And in some sense, that has some feel of what's called amortized inference, where you try to reconstruct the latent state, but you have a sort of fixed function that's very fast to compute. And so if you have something like that, you can also maybe just, you know, shortcut and go from a high-level latent state to the estimate of the high-level latent state, but instead of a variational approach, by just basically having some feature engineering fast simulation approach. So here are just some pictures of the quality of the modeling, because I think this might, you know, I just want to, I think this is pretty impressive. So notice that these are all logarithmic axes. And so we're looking at distributions over many orders of magnitude, 6, 7 orders of magnitude. And look at the level, the quality of the modeling, right? I mean, it's pretty spot on. We're getting the tails right. Nothing looks like a Gaussian. The other thing to know is that what's happening here is that the modeling is a mixture model, because there's several different kinds of processes happening. So you stack all these histograms on top of each other, and then you have a Poisson point process sitting on top of it. So it's basically mixtures of inhomogeneous point processes. And here's just an example of a real, remember these are real events. So here's a real collision event that CMS collected, which was an incredibly high energy di muon, blah, blah, blah. And you get this this event way out on the tails in the bottom right of their distribution. So we've done lots and lots of measurements with this approach. All of these little dots are measurements, and all the bars are the predictions. And basically, you know, we keep confirming predictions of the standard model. But again, look at the vertical scale. That's logarithmic. There's like, you know, I can't read it. It goes from 10 to the 11 to 10 to the minus 3. So there's 14 orders of magnitude that we're making measurements in the same data set. So the modeling is pretty impressive. So here's back to our friendly Higgs event that we saw before. And we can do feature engineering for that, which I'm basically going to skip, but it's based on energy and momentum conservation. And you get, this is what you expect. And the kind of blue and green is what you would expect the data to look like if there is no Higgs particle. And the red is what you would expect if there is also a Higgs particle. And so we're just doing very simple hypothesis testing at that stage. But this one variable is, you know, very good discriminator. You can see very clearly the difference between signal and background. And you can now look in the data, and the data does indeed prefer that there's a Higgs there. And this is what it looks like as we collected the data over time. And there's clearly like a big, huge bump there, right? And so this is you know, how the discovery was made. And when we did the inference from this very high level feature to the parameters, we used collaborative statistical modeling. And this is something that I like a lot, is that each one of those plots is a different way that the Higgs could decay. There's a team of people trying to study each one of those plots. They come up with a statistical model, and then we combine it all together in this kind of crazy looking plot, which is mathematically described by the equation below, which is basically a product of Poisson point processes. Now, once we introduce the sort of software to be able to do this collaborative statistical modeling, which is sort of a probabilistic programming language, the complexity of our statistical model started to grow exponentially. So you see from 2009 to 2014 that the models just became very, very complicated because we had this very convenient way to collaborate. And I stopped being able to make that plot that I showed you was actually in 2011. So they got much more complicated after that, and I can't draw them anymore. So through that is what led us to sitting in a room and talking amongst ourselves and seeing if we believed the evidence. And then we claimed the discovery of the particle, which then led to the Nobel Prize in 2013 to Peter Higgs and Francois Englert, who was sort of instrumental in the whole story theoretically. Now, So we've had a big success. We know how to do likelihood-free inference, but we only know how to do it with like one-dimensional or two-dimensional data, which is not super exciting, especially for a crowd like this. So how do we do it if we want to work with high-dimensional versions of the data? Because density estimation is not going to scale. So there is an approach to this likelihood-free inference that's called approximate Bayesian computation. I'd like to thank Balazs Kegel early on for telling me about ABC and this. And it was through this means that I started, you know, thinking about likelihood-free inference and, you know, in those terms. And I just like to highlight a few things because there were, you know, a few NIPS workshops on ABC. And so, again, they're pointing to intractable likelihoods, the idea that it was developed largely beyond the radar of the machine learning community at first. So that's kind of nice to know that, and sometimes, you know, other fields come up with good ideas. And then it's applicable to a large and diverse segment of the scientific community. And they mentioned systems and population biology, computational neuroscience, computer vision, health sciences, and many others. And I'm not going to be too offended that they left out particle physics. One of the reasons I bring this up in these quotes is that it's very important for us to figure out to get over this language barrier. And to me, the language of likelihood-free inference has been very, very important for me to be able to translate this mechanistic picture of simulations and things into an inferential machine learning language. And there's a quote from a similar effort, probabilisticnumerics.org. They say, it's a joint framework for methods developed in separate communities, and it allows for transfer of knowledge among these areas. So language is very important, and I think that likelihood-free inference is definitely onto something when we're talking about at least the certain kinds of sciences. So ABC, I will just super duper quickly talk about ABC, but the basic idea here is that you're trying to do some sort of posterior sampling of your parameters, but you don't know how to evaluate the likelihood, so standard Markov chain Monte Carlo is not going to work. But there's a kind of funny variant to it, where you as you move around the parameter space, you propose some point, and then you generate some data using your computer simulator at that point. And if the data is exactly the data that you observed, then you accept that point. And if it's not, you reject it. It seems like a kind of crazy idea, but it does give you exact inference. The problem is that it has very, very small acceptance, and if you're dealing with continuous variables, it has zero acceptance. So it's not practical. So the idea of ABC essentially is that you're going to do the same thing, move around the parameter space, generate some fake data, and then if the data looks close to your real data, then you'll accept the point. And close is then with respect to what measure, and so they have this idea rho of d comma x, which is the similarity measure between the observed data and the real data. So that's an approach. It gives you approximate inference, not exact inference. And so then this was a great quote from David during the variational to a question that came up. I don't actually know the question, but the answer was, do you want the wrong answer to the right question or the right answer to the wrong question? And I think you want the former. So I think that's sort of the attitude, I guess, of the approximate inference strategies. And I see where they're coming from. Of course, as a physicist, I want the right answer to the right question. But that might, you know, maybe that's asking too much. But maybe not. So let's explore that a little bit. So here's a big table. And it has the rows are all sorts of ideas that are floating around in this very rapidly evolving, very, very exciting space. On one side, you have inference ideas. On the other side, you have generative models like GANs and variational autoencoders and things like that. And then they all are kind of fixed together because they're related to this sort of dual-sided arrow that I have at the top. So I'll go through it quickly. So the approximate Bayesian computation, the first row, its goal is to estimate a posterior of the parameters given some observed data. It does work in the likelihood-free setting. It gives you approximate inference on theta, but it doesn't help you at all with trying to generate more data. You just use your computer simulation. It's not trying to solve that problem. It's not trying to make your computer simulation faster or learn a generative model. And so if your computer simulation is really slow, that it's not helping you out with that. Then there's black box variational inference, which is trying to give you a posterior over the parameters and maybe the latent variables given your data. But it does not work in the likelihood-free setting, and so you can't do you can't do inference, and you can't and et cetera. Now we'd heard about generative adversarial networks and conditional generative adversarial networks, which are trying to give you distributions of the data given some parameters, and they work in the likelihood-free setting, but they don't help you with inference. So we had done some work about, which I'm calling Carl here, this is work together with Gilles Loup and Juan Pavez, which is somewhere in the middle of these, where you're trying to estimate a likelihood ratio. It works in the likelihood-free setting. It gives you exact inference, but it's not really trying to solve the problem of giving you a generative model, but you do kind of get to it through this connection with importance sampling. So for time, I'm just going to go kind of quickly. So here is the approach for Carl. I would love to talk about it more. I'm going to have to be kind of quick. But roughly the idea is that at the top, we have this intractable likelihood ratio that we would like to be able to compute, which we can't. But we can show that you can have an equivalent likelihood ratio if you can do a dimensionality reduction on the data. That's what I call S of X. And that dimensionality reduction map is a scalar function that's monotonic with the likelihood ratio that you don't know how to compute. And then you can calibrate this thing. You don't have to know how to invert that monotonic relationship because you can just calibrate it by using samples from the generator. And then you're set for doing likelihood free inference. And now the question is, how do I learn S of X? And it turns out that that's what binary classification does. If you just do balanced training with 0 and 1 labels for binary classification, the function that you learn is 1 to 1 with the likelihood ratio. And now you just do this not just for two binary hypotheses, but you do it for any two points in your parameter space. That's at the bottom. So you have this parametrized family of classifiers, and that will solve the problem for you. So we have some software for it, and we've started to use it. I'm going to skip ahead. We're using it for the Higgs. And what we're seeing there is that these are contours in the parameter space comparing a high-dimensional likelihood-free inference and a low-dimensional version of it. And what we see is by using higher-dimensional data, we get much better results. And that can be equivalent to something like 3 times more data, which would be huge for the LHC. OK. Now, I'm going to sort of scoot along here. This part, I'm just going to kind of do block diagrams through the through this picture that I started with. So this part of the diagram that I circled in red is the generative model part of what's going on. And I think there's a lot of excitement about trying to figure out if we can learn this expensive simulation. And so can we do something like GANs, but instead of making images, we're simulating what the detector data looks like. This is also coming up in areas like cosmology, where they want to know what they want to generate a bunch of examples of what galaxies look like, and they want to use that to calibrate the statistical procedures that follow. If you're going to do this, you're going to need access to the simulation. If we want to partner with machine learning, we need to have the tools available for them. And so we've sort of written a short opinion piece about this, and that's starting to happen. So at the very top left, the very first part of the simulation, this is some work that my student Lucas did. So he's encapsulated the first part of the generative model into Docker. And if you go to this repository, you can click the launch binder button with your phone if you want, and you can run the simulation that's starting from quantum field theory and going to what we expect to see on your phone in a nice encapsulated way. So this is not maybe as exciting as Universe or DeepMind's labs, but this is the sort of particle physics version of that. Okay, so now this last bit, I would like to just sort of focus on the going from the very low level data to higher and higher level data. And can I check on my time also? Am I kind of, I should be ending? Okay. All right, here we go. I'll be a little bit more than that, but so we're going to propagate from low level to the very high level data, and this is very much like what was happening with the kind of deep learning revolution, where you, instead of hand engineered features or step by step versions of maybe using some machine learning, you want to have kind of end to end learning from the very low level to mid level to high level features, and to try to learn all of that jointly. So the very first work that was done along these lines went from kind of mid-level to the very high level, and that was a sort of breakthrough work by Pierre Baldi, Peter Sadowski, and Daniel Whiteson that were applying deep neural networks to these particle physics problems. And what we saw was that shallow neural networks really required hand-engineered features to perform well, and deep neural networks did not. You could just give them the low-level features, and they would do fine, and they would not improve if you gave them high-level features. So that was breakthrough work. And now we're trying to go lower and lower into the scheme. So let's try to work at a pretty low level and propagate up. And so one of the exciting ideas here is what is called jet images. So here you see sprays of particles flying into the detector. They project that into an image. And then you, for instance, try to do classification. So these are two different kinds of processes. The images are slightly different. This is the average image. And you want to try to do classification with them. And those sort of deep convolutional networks are performing quite well. The problem with them, though, is that when you do this discretization of the particles into an image, you lose a lot of information. The other problem is those were idealized simulations, and our real detectors are not uniform, and if you try to predict them into a grid, you're going to have all sorts of aliasing effects. So I'll just kind of quickly show this, that we've tried to move from images to sentences, and using this analogy that words are going to be like particles, and the parsing of a sentence is going to be what we call a jet algorithm. So here we're using jet algorithms inspired by physics to try to give structure to these events. This is work that I'm doing with Jill Loop and Kanyan Cho and Cyril Beko. And we've seen that if we go from the images to the particles, this is sort of like a rock curve, but presented in a different way. We see that we get there's a huge potential for improvement by working with the lower level. And also, these kinds of recurrent networks take a lot less data to train, and that's a big deal for us. So I have more slides, which for time I'm not going to be able to go through, about sort of jet embeddings and event embeddings, which is all very exciting. Ideas about systematic uncertainties, adversarial training to be robust against systematic uncertainties. But instead, I'll just end with this, is that the dream that you would like to do that seemed impossible at the beginning of the talk is to be able to deal with data of this complexity and of this scale and to try to go from the kind of traditional physics way and hand-engineered features and mechanistic models to a sort of AI end-to-end learning approach. And I think that we're starting to have ideas of generative models and the sort of deep learning pipeline, and then to be able to potentially put that all together into an inference generative model kind of super package to be able to do end-to-end learning, and that would be amazing. This would require a lot of work, but in terms of a vision for the field, it's exciting. And I think it goes back to this point at the beginning, is that where should AI start? Maybe this is the more immediate practical thing that we could try to tackle if we had some engineering and great ideas and great minds attacking these kinds of problems. And not to say that we shouldn't be working on ecology and language and all these things, but those are hard problems where the causal structure is unclear and et cetera. Maybe we should have a parallel effort where we start with these more mechanistic models. And with that, I'll say thanks.
Thank you so much for this inspiring talk. Please come to the microphone for questions. Derek?
Yeah, spectacular results. And the success really depended on the fact that you had a theory. And you knew exactly what you're looking for. And you're able to sort through a needle in a haystack and pick out exactly the evidence that you needed to answer the question, the mass. But you started out at the beginning of the talk about these big uncertainties about dark matter and dark energy, where you don't have really good theory or evidence for what it consists of. And I was wondering if the community has thought about using other tools and techniques, unsupervised learning to actually, do hypothesis discovery rather than hypothesis testing.
Right. No, it's a fantastic question. So in the context of dark matter and dark energy, we don't know what it is, but we do have this very controlled language to talk about what it could be. Somehow, ideas of symmetries and energy conservation and stuff like that are so restrictive that we can talk about a class of possibilities, which is a kind of a softer notion of a theory, and we usually work inside of that context. If you try to really loosen up the assumptions, of course, it becomes much harder. And that is very much at the back of people, well, not at the back of, now at the front of people's minds for the LHC, because we have been looking for all these other things, supersymmetry and dark matter, and we are not finding it. And so people want to relax those assumptions a lot. But the hard part is that whatever it is probably still 10 to the minus 9 of the data. And so how do you do that? And that is very hard. And so the idea is that maybe if we start with this, with these examples of these mechanistic models, and we have this AI system that does like end-to-end learning, at that point we might be able to free up the models to start doing unsupervised learning, learning from the data, and start to tackle those. I think we can be doing both in parallel, but I think it does make sense to try, as you're remarking last night, actually, it makes a lot of sense to try with specific problems first instead of trying to jump all the way to some completely unsupervised approach. Thank you.
Hi, Kyle.
Hi.
Thank you for a really broad coverage, Shakir, this time.
Hi, thank you.
I wanted to share, I had one comment and just a different perspective on some of the work that you mentioned and one question. So the comment that I had was sort of related to the likelihood-free inference and one other area of computational science that you didn't mention, which is in econometrics and economics. And the perspective of likelihood-free inference in economics is called indirect inference. And the principle of an indirect inference is because you don't have access to a likelihood, you cannot apply the principles of maximum likelihood learning. So instead, what you have to do, as you said, is build a surrogate function, which indirectly through that function you learn about your model. There's really a lot of work in this area, really great books, and you know, one of the other useful theories for us to learn about likelihood-free methods in addition to ABC, GANs, etc. The question I actually had was, typically the models that you have are not differentiable, and we like differentiable models in machine learning, and what are the sort of techniques? If I were thinking, I would think about using finite differences, for example, or some evolutionary search, or some, you know, like gradient-free method, but what for you are the good ways of estimating gradients, for example, or learning those algorithms? Right. Thanks.
Yeah, so excellent question and point. In terms of econometrics, I agree. I'm sort of just scratched the surface of that enormous body of literature, and I think you could have very much the analogous kind of talk of someone trying to make that translation between physics and econometrics, or between that audience and this audience. In terms of what we're doing with particle physics, it's true. I think a lot of these simulations are not differentiable, and so I think there's two strategies, broad strategies there. Well, maybe three. One is, to the extent that they could be differentiable, people just didn't code it up that way. You know, we should put some effort into the engineering of the software to make them be differentiable. And that's actually a conversation we're having, but it's a lot of software. You know, it's decades of effort. And so it's not a small task to sort of revisit the infrastructure for these simulations. But I think that is an interesting idea, is to try to redo them with AutoGrad and things like that in mind. AutoDiff in mind. The other thing is, and when we do need to do optimization, for whatever reason, particle physicists rarely try to actually do optimization on the simulation through some sort of stochastic approach that just doesn't happen very often. Usually what we do is we sample on a grid and then we interpolate. And that's kind of along the lines of learning a surrogate of the function. And so I think a lot of the work that I was alluding to is more along that line, that you use the simulator in a smarter way than a grid, you know, parameter search, and then you build a surrogate. And that might either be like a Gaussian process, or it might use some sort of deep learning ideas inside.
Hi, Kyle.
Fascinating talk. Sorry. Okay. A fascinating talk. Thank you very much. Oh, right here.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Hi.
So I'm just curious, did anybody try the distributed vector representations in physics for resonances? It should probably help. And one can come up also with sketchy words like quark to weck.
Right.
Something
right.
Like that. It might be actually very helpful. Also, of course, it might be possible, like in word to weck, for example, there is interesting linear structure. You can add and subtract words to move them from one meaning to another. So might
right.
be the same thing will work with particles.
Right. So that was what I was kind of getting at here with when we were making these slides, we were making this analogy between words and particles and parsings and jet algorithms. So we start to embed particles and then propagate them through these kinds of structures that then embed jets. So they're jet to vec. And then we actually then feed them into something higher level, which is now an event level embedding. And then you can start to do all of these kinds of ideas of adding and subtracting events in this kind of latent representation.
Kyle, thank great you. Talk. Just a quick question. You mentioned the difficulty of using likelihoods or computing the likelihoods, but then you also talked about the kind of more Bayesian perspective. Can you comment on what it means to have a prior over a fundamental physics constant?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. So particle physics is one of the last bastions of frequentism. Part of the issue is that we have no problem putting priors over latent variables. We have not a huge problem over putting priors over nuisance parameters. But when you start putting priors over fundamental constants of nature, that is, you know, much more bothersome because we don't, I mean, most physicists I know don't think that there's a distribution over the Higgs mass or, you know, what the universe, we think of our universe, that's a fixed value. And if you can parameterize the theory in lots of ways, like aliens might have a theory for the standard model that's parameterized very differently. And like, how are you going to put a prior on that? It's not like a population of people where you're talking about what's the prior that you have some disease or something, right? It's a very fundamental question. I think it's one of the reasons why physicists tend to not do Bayesian on the high level parameters. It does happen, but a lot of times they're not very interesting priors. Like uniform is like lazy Bayesians. Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate this very much.
Let's thank the speaker again.